Chapter 13. The Wall Street Conspiracy. The Incident. America's worst economic crisis since the Great Depression occurred in the fall of 2008, brought on originally by the collapse of a housing bubble that damaged financial institutions and caused the stock market to plummet. The official word: huge corporations like AIG and Goldman Sachs were considered too big to fail, and received multi-billion-dollar bailouts from the federal government in order to prevent economic collapse. My take: the government has conspired to keep the fat cats in business, while the American taxpayers are left holding the bag. CEOs that should be going to jail for scams beyond belief are instead reaping the biggest bonuses ever. Corporations basically run the government, and the same players that made the mess still have a stranglehold on our future. Too much cannot be said against the men of wealth who sacrifice everything to getting wealth. There is not in the world a more ignoble character than the mere money-getting American, insensible to every duty, regardless of every principle, bent only on amassing a fortune, and putting his fortune only to the basest uses. Theodore Roosevelt, 1895. If you're surprised to find what's been happening to our economy in a book on American conspiracies, you shouldn't be. This may be the granddaddy of all plots, one that's been going on for almost a century, although I'm not one who blames all our national woes on the trilateral Bilderberg Bohemian Grove crowd. Before diving into what I've been learning about the big financial institutions and their cronies in government and at the Federal Reserve, let me suggest you quickly review the earlier chapter about the Wall Street plot to overthrow FDR and the insights of Professor Carol Quigley. The economy and how it got into its current mess is a complicated, tangled tale, and I certainly don't claim to be an expert about it. But you can learn a great deal from some thoughtful reading. Let's face it, capitalism isn't always fair. So if you're looking to bring fairness to life, you have to take steps more towards socialism, which then causes a conflict of interest, because socialism means you're going to be even more controlled in your decision-making by the establishment. Then again, is that what's required to keep an equal balance? Do you have to go that way to ensure that the middle class survives? What I really see leaving is the American dream. The destruction of the middle class means you're no longer going to have that dream, which is that a young person can achieve anything if you put your mind to it, because the opportunities are there. Now, are they still? Yes, but are they more difficult? Yes. I see many more obstacles in the way of the American dream today, and a great deal of it caused by greed. It's understood that a certain amount of wealthy people are going to control the majority of the money. But when it's moving so drastically that you've got 5% of the people having 90% of the money, that can't be healthy. Deregulated free market capitalism sure hasn't benefited the American people. We've had a revolving door between Wall Street and Washington, which led to a Wild West mentality on the street. For a while, the whole casino seemed to be doing just fine, but really the financial sector was completely out of control, running on a perverse set of incentives that made it incredibly profitable to essentially throw caution to the wind and take on incomprehensible amounts of risk. Don't let them fool you into thinking it was reckless borrowers and subprime loans that built the house of cards. In this chapter, I'm going to particularly zero in on the greed and excesses of two companies, banking giant Goldman Sachs and insurance behemoth American International Group, better known as AIG. They're atop the pyramid of the too-big-to-let-fail crowd, and their execs are still getting richer while the home foreclosures increase and the unemployment numbers keep rising. until it received the largest government subsidy that any corporation ever has, about $170 billion in bailouts, the tab being picked up by we, the taxpayers, AIG was the biggest private insurance company in the world. It had more than 100,000 employees globally and $1 trillion in assets. Their history is worth looking into. AIG started out selling insurance to the Chinese in 1919, based in Shanghai, where it was then called American Asiatic Underwriters. The company was founded by Cornelius van der Staar, the uncle of Ken Starr, future special prosecutor of Bill Clinton. Starr moved his headquarters to New York 20 years later, but kept his Asian branch going. Soon after World War II began, General Wild Bill Donovan of the OSS started using his contacts to create a deep cover intel network over there. Files were finally declassified in 2000, showing how OSS set up an ultra-secret insurance unit through Starr, which perused records on the Japanese to find blueprints of possible targets. As victory against the Nazis approached, U.S. intelligence began examining ways the Nazis would try to use insurance to hide and launder their assets so they could be used to rebuild the war machine. Starr sent insurance agents into Asia and Europe even before the bombs stopped falling, and built what eventually became AIG, which today has its world headquarters in the same downtown New York building where the tiny OSS unit toiled in the deepest secrecy. After the CIA was founded in 1947, AIG was tied into figures like Paul Helliwell, who ran air transport companies with connections to the drug trade. Helliwell was legal counsel for Starr's insurance interests. Drugs came up again 40 years later, when in 1987, AIG made a deal with Goldman Sachs and the Arkansas Development Financial Authority, ADFA, to found an offshore reinsurer in Barbados called Coral Ray. The ADFA allegedly helped launder drug money for Barry Seal, the Contras, and the Medellin cartel out of Mena, Arkansas. In 2000, AIG's annual report announced its fleet of 494 full-size jets was the world's most modern fleet of aircraft, including leasing still more planes to a number of established customers in Latin America. It helps to have friends in high places with deep pockets. Hank Greenberg had been appointed as director of AIG's North American operations in 1962, and after Starr died 6 years later, Greenberg became chairman of AIG, CV, Starr & Company, and today's Starr International, which is an offshore company incorporated in Panama with a Bermuda headquarters and still the biggest shareholder in AIG. Seems rather incestuous, but that's the way it is. AIG became the biggest foreign insurance company in Japan, and more than one-third of its $40 billion in revenues in 1999 came from the Far East Theater. Starr helped carpet bomb and liberate. Greenberg let AIG be used by the CIA for placing many of its Asian officers and continued to keep tabs for the company on places like China, Japan, Korea, Singapore, Hong Kong, and Taiwan. The company's massive database in San Francisco was also made available to CIA. In 1995, Greenberg was one of the candidates to become the next CIA director. It's a small, tight-knit world, and they don't call AIG's favorite trading partner Government Sachs for nothing. Treasury secretaries under two previous presidents, Robert Rubin with Clinton and Hank Paulson with Bush II, went from running Goldman Sachs into the most powerful financial position in the administrations. That's just for openers. The company pretty much had a lock on high-level jobs at Treasury. Neil Kashkari, pronounced Cash Carry, started out as a low-level Goldman investment banker and now runs the bailout under the Government Office of Financial Stability. Are we surprised that AIG and Goldman became the biggest beneficiaries in the bailout? Goldman Sachs' history has some intrigue in it, too. This company was founded back in 1869 by Marcus Goldman, a German immigrant who slowly built it up with his son-in-law, Samuel Sachs. They made a killing off the 1929 stock market crash and applied that knowledge later to the dot-com and housing booms. The formula of the most influential investment bank on the planet has been described like this. Goldman positions itself in the middle of a speculative bubble, selling investments they know are crap. Then they hoover up vast sums from the middle and lower floors of society with the aid of a crippled and corrupt state that allows it to rewrite the rules in exchange for the relative pennies the bank throws at political patronage. Finally, when it all goes bust, leaving millions of ordinary citizens broke and starving, they begin the entire process over again, riding in to rescue us all by lending us back our own money at interest, selling themselves as men above greed, just a bunch of really smart guys keeping the wheels greased. To get a grasp on what's lately been going on, we also need to take a look at our central bank, otherwise known as the Federal Reserve. The Fed controls our monetary policy. By changing the supply of dollars in circulation, they have influence over interest rates, mortgage payments, whether the financial markets boom or collapse, and basically whether our economy expands or stumbles. But the Fed is only partly an institution of government. The stockholders in a dozen different Federal Reserve banks in different regions of the country are the big private banks. The Federal Reserve was created by Congress in 1913 after a financial panic that led to a secret meeting at banker J.P. Morgan's private resort off the coast of Georgia at a place called Jekyll Island. I'm not sure if Hyde was present. Those who attended represented the great financial institutions of Wall Street and, indirectly, Europe as well. The reason for secrecy was simple. Had it been known that rival factions of the banking community had joined together, the public would have been alerted to the possibility that the bankers were plotting an agreement in restraint of trade, which, of course, is exactly what they were doing. What emerged was a cartel agreement with five objectives: stop the growing competition from the nation's newer banks, obtain a franchise to create money out of nothing for the purpose of lending, get control of the reserves of all banks so that the more reckless ones would not be exposed to currency drains and bank runs, get the taxpayer to pick up the cartel's inevitable losses, and convince Congress that the purpose was to protect the public. It was realized that the bankers would have to become partners with the politicians and that the structure of the cartel would have to be a central bank. These are some of the same players who wanted to take down FDR during the Great Depression. During his last year in office, JFK then made an attempt to strip the Federal Reserve of its power to loan money to the government at interest. Executive Order No. 11110 gave Treasury back the power to issue currency and not have to go through the Federal Reserve. Kennedy put nearly $4.3 billion into circulation of U.S. notes backed by silver certificates, whereas the Federal Reserve's notes aren't backed by anything. The handwriting was on the wall. They could soon be out of business. But guess what? After JFK was assassinated only 5 months later, there weren't any more silver certificates issued. The executive order has never been repealed, but not a single president since has chosen to utilize it. Dare I say it? Will my life be at risk? I'd like to see us back on some type of standard where our money truly has value. My big problem with the Federal Reserve is Why does the government allow this monopoly that's in bed with the banking industry to make basically all of our country's financial decisions? Those people aren't elected. We form these other entities that are permitted to make policy when, in reality, they're unconstitutional. The public has to be involved in the process, our Constitution says. Here, whoever controls the money has the power. So the Federal Reserve is really more powerful than the government, and we don't elect them. Once Reagan and the free market ideologues came to power in 1980, FDR and JFK's legacies were like a distant memory. Alan Greenspan, named as Fed chairman by Reagan, backed up my previous point, writing, "The Federal Reserve is an independent agency, and that means basically that there is no other agency of government which can overrule actions that we take." Does that sound like democracy or something else? The new era of deregulation resulted in a boom time for the rich getting richer. Reagan opened wide the door for companies to gamble with taxpayers' money, or loot it outright, as in the savings and loan scandal and bailout. The New Deal restrictions on mortgage lending went by the boards, which eventually led to the foreclosure crisis. In 1999, the Glass-Steagall Act was repealed by a bipartisan Congress during Clinton's last year, and a real free-for-all began. You might not know how important this legislation was. It was passed in 1933 to keep separate the low-risk commercial banks where we put our deposits and the brokerage banks that engage in high-risk speculative investments. This worked just fine for more than 50 years. During the Reagan years, the lobbyists for the finance, insurance, and real estate outfits started pushing to dump the law. Rubin and Greenspan got behind them. When this law got wiped off the books, the rules of the game changed totally. Mergers and commercial investment partnerships skyrocketed. Now commercial banks like Citigroup could start taking multiple home mortgage loans and turning them into securities to trade on Wall Street. They could all gamble like crazy with billions raised from predatory lending practices and very little regulation. How insane was it to destroy one of the main protection devices created out of the pain of the Great Depression and let Wall Street gamble with what had been Main Street's money? But Congress wasn't done yet. In 2000, after getting some heat from a regulator named Brooksley Bourne about the need to regulate commodities trading, legislation was slipped into an 11,000-page spending bill to exempt derivatives from any oversight on the very last day of the session. Wonder how many Congress people read that one? Probably about as many as read the Patriot Act, I suspect. Enter George W. Bush with a rousing mandate of freedom, freedom, as Richie Havens once sang at Woodstock. You'd think something might have been learned from the scandals that sank Enron and WorldCom soon after Bush took office. Instead, this administration made decisions that allowed the free market to operate as a barroom brawl. Bank regulators took a chainsaw to thousands of pages of troublesome things that Wall Street objected to. States that tried to do something about predatory lending were blocked by the Federal Comptroller of the Currency. Back in 2003, the Office of Federal Housing Enterprise Oversight warned that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the icons that held trillions in mortgages, were in deep doo-doo. But the Bush White House set out to deep six Armando Falcon's report and replace him with a Bush buddy from their prep school days together. To W., home ownership was at an all-time peak, and that was what America was all about, forgetting that thousands of those people couldn't really afford the loan payments. When the House of Cards collapsed, W. commented that Wall Street got drunk. I guess it takes one to know one. The Securities and Exchange Commission was another legacy of the New Deal, a watchdog agency created after Wall Street had pushed our economy over the cliff. Bush sliced its budget, and his first SEC chairman promised a kinder, gentler agency. It sure was when it came to looking the other way. They did 6 investigations into Bernie Madoff and knew back in 2005 that he was running a Ponzi scheme, taking bucks from new victims and using it to reimburse some of the old ones. Madoff said in a jailhouse interview that nobody was more surprised than he was when he didn't get busted long ago. But, like Bernie once said, in today's regulatory environment, it's virtually impossible to violate rules. And this is something the public really doesn't know. So he was able to scam folks out of at least $50 billion. Once he couldn't come up with any more investors, and people started asking for their money back, they found out that Bernie had none left. It had all gone toward financing his yachts and a number of mansions. Eventually, SEC Chairman Christopher Cox admitted they'd failed to check out multiple credible and specific allegations regarding Mr. Madoff's financial wrongdoing. In fact, the agency had been missing numerous red flags since at least 1992. It took one in-house expert all of 20 minutes to figure out that Madoff's claims were bogus. But somehow, that analysis didn't make it to the SEC's investigative team. After Bush's second SEC chairman wanted to regulate high rollers playing fast and loose with their hedge funds, he got dumped fast. There was even a hotline for Wall Street companies to ring up SEC brass to stop an investigation or slow it down. Then again, for many SEC attorneys, especially those atop the enforcement division, their time at the agency is a stop on their way to 7-figure jobs representing Wall Street elite. Through most of the 8 Bush years, insurance giant AIG was having a grand old party at the bottomless money pit. Elliot Spitzer, as Attorney General of New York, had begun investigating AIG, especially its shady affiliates like the Coral Ray outfit in Barbados. CEO Greenberg was forced to resign during an accounting scandal in 2005. It looked like the jig might be up, but it wasn't too long after that when Spitzer, by then governor of New York, was forced to resign when his involvement with a prostitution ring suddenly became public. And now that our own government holds 80% of AIG stock as part of the $85 billion bridge loan bailout, don't bet on much scrutiny from outsiders anymore. The day after that deal was made, AIG's top execs took a nose-thumbing retreat at a luxury spa, costing $443,000 of what was now taxpayer money. Before he resigned, Greenberg had appointed a guy named Joseph Cassano to run AIG's Financial Products Unit, FPU, and given him all the rein he wanted. Cassano had gotten his start at Drexel Burnham Lambert under junk bond king Michael Milken, who ended up going to prison. A number of Drexel's employees, Cassano included, just moved over to the FPU, where they started dealing in securities called credit default swaps. Same scam, same players, simply a different name for leveraging worthless paper to sell to clueless investors. These swaps, like collateralized debt obligations or CDOs, are so complicated that even a lot of CEOs can't make heads or tails of them. Cassano established dozens of companies, many offshore, to keep all the transactions off AIG's books and out of sight of regulators here and at the London casino. Nobody inside the company apparently noticed things on the accounting books, like Liechtenstein subsidiary profit, $10 billion. The government's Office of Thrift Supervision was supposed to be keeping an eye on the FPU, but it thought the swaps were fairly benign products, because that's what AIG told them. Meantime, the FPU was transforming these into the world's biggest bet on the housing boom, and until the bottom fell out of the subprime mortgage scam, they made a ton of money doing it. Hank Paulson was still Goldman's CEO in 2004 when he went to the SEC and petitioned to have lending restrictions relaxed for the five leading investment banks. Then Goldman went berserk with lending lust. By the peak of the housing boom in 2006, Goldman was underwriting $76.5 billion worth of mortgage-backed securities, a third of which were subprime, much of it to institutional investors like pensions and insurance companies. And in those massive issues of real estate were vast swamps of crap. Crap that permitted Goldman to pay each employee roughly $350,000 a year. Moving on to become Treasury Secretary, Paulson declared in 2007 that the American economy was the strongest in decades. When our gas prices spiked to $4 and up a gallon in the summer of 2008, resulting in all the outcry about needing to drill for more oil offshore, the reality was that Goldman Sachs, the biggest trader in the energy derivatives market, had led the way by issuing high analyst predictions for the price of oil. A Goldman guy in 2008 talked up $200 a barrel and buying up oil futures. They could move the markets by stimulating other investors to jump in and then selling oil back to them at the higher price. By 2008, a barrel of oil was traded 27 times on average before it was actually delivered and consumed. Once again, a Depression-era law had been lifted, thanks to Goldman, that previously kept commodities markets in check. Between 2003 and 2008, the amount of speculative money in commodities grew from $13 billion to $317 billion, an increase of 2,300%. There was no oil shortage, except when it was convenient for Goldman and its cronies. There was only one rub to it all. Early in 2008, Cassano got fired after the huge losses of his arm of AIG became known. Black September wasn't far away. This crisis wasn't about the little guy. It was a bailout of these financial giants, unprecedented in our history, because they were too big to fail. For the money spent on subsidizing the industry, the government could have bought out every single outstanding mortgage in the country, plus every student loan and everyone's health insurance. And on top of that, still have trillions of dollars left over. That's what a former managing director at Goldman Sachs, Noémie Prinz, is laying out in her muckraking book titled, It Takes a Pillage. The behind-the-scenes story of the taxpayer-funded bailout is still emerging. I'd like to have been a fly on the wall when Hank Paulson called the Big Nine kleptocrats into his office at Treasury for an emergency chat in September 2008. Remember how Lehman Brothers, the heaviest competitor to Goldman Sachs, was allowed to go broke? Well, that's because Paulson's crew wouldn't let them become a bank holding company and thus qualify for federal bucks. That's exactly the deal Goldman got, remember? It's Paulson's former company, which was worth a quick $10 billion. Goldman had kept right on selling questionable mortgage derivatives to unsuspecting buyers, even while playing smart and divesting its own. This looks to me like a clear case of fraud that ought to land some people in prison. I can't help but believe there was method to this madness, that it was all designed. I learned in Minnesota that it should not be government's place to pick winners and losers, but to make policy that all have to follow. The disturbing thing is how this was utterly manipulated by the government. Paulson also gave billions to Bank of America so it could pay an inflated price to rescue Merrill Lynch, whose CEO, John Thain, had once headed Goldman's mortgage desk and then was CEO of the New York Stock Exchange. While Merrill Lynch was going belly up, Thain was busy buying an $87,000 area rug for his office and a $35,000 toilet bowl. Some might call him a four-flusher, since he'd lost about $15 billion in just 3 months at Merrill Lynch, and Bank of America then decided to fire Thain when he demanded a $30 million bonus. Oh, by the way, Thain was a mentor of Timothy Geithner, who's now Treasury Secretary under Obama. Then came the bailout of AIG. We were told that if AIG collapsed, every large American financial institution and a lot of foreign ones would have gone under with them. Guess who sat in on the closed-door meeting where Paulson and Geithner, who then headed the New York Fed, made the decision to rescue them? Goldman CEO Lloyd Blankfein, who'd have been in major trouble if they didn't. That week, Paulson's calendars show he spoke to Blankfein 2 dozen times, far more than to any other Wall Street exec. Birds of a feather and all that. The government then wrote Goldman a $12.9 billion check to cover its losses to AIG, which were predicated on contractual arrangements that would have been worthless had AIG gone bankrupt. Other AIG trading partners who bought subprime insurance got saved too, like Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Citigroup. Hallelujah. The way Eliot Spitzer sees it, the appearance that this was all an inside job is overwhelming. AIG was nothing more than a conduit for huge capital flows to the same old suspects, with no reason or explanation. What did AIG do with $181 billion altogether in taxpayer-funded bailouts? Do Americans realize that our money went to pay off foreign debt owed by private enterprise in the U.S.? When rescued, AIG had at least $40 billion in credit default swaps outstanding. $11.9 billion went to pay its debt to France's Société Générale, and $11.8 billion more went to Deutsche Bank of Germany, and $8.5 billion to Barclays Bank in Britain. During the last 3 months of 2008, AIG was losing more than $27 million an hour, or $465,000 every minute. With numbers like that, Bernie Madoff comes off as chump change. But they were still giving bonuses totaling around $450 million to everybody in the financial products unit, the very same people who'd bankrupted the company. Until Congress did an intervention, Joe Cassano continued to pull down $1 million a month salary. This whole bailout business stinks, and we've been left holding the bag. That original $700 billion bailout figure has mushroomed into a commitment that includes about $1.1 trillion in taxpayer money. Total financial support from the Fed, Treasury, and FDIC is actually around $3 trillion, with potential support authorized of $23.7 trillion. One economist says government officials see all this as a three-card Monte, moving everything around really quickly so the public won't understand that this really is an elaborate way to subsidize the banks, and won't realize we gave money away to some of the richest people. Wasn't the expectation that once it got rescued, Wall Street would then be good sports and send money into creating jobs and initiating a major recovery? But the big banks didn't start lending again. Instead, they hoarded the cash and paid out huge bonuses to their execs. The behemoths got even more beastly. Today, J.P. Morgan Chase holds more than 1 out of every $10 on deposit in America. Bank of America, and Wells Fargo are close behind. Those three plus Citigroup now issue one-half of all mortgages and about two-thirds of our credit cards. The big guys can borrow more cheaply because creditors assume they're at no risk for failing. Incredibly, despite the events of last fall, nearly every one of Wall Street's proprietary trading desks can still take huge risks. And then, if they get into trouble, head to the Federal Reserve for short-term rescue financing. Presiding over the money pit is Gentle Ben Bernanke, whom Obama reappointed to head the Federal Reserve. Even though they were a major contributor to the disaster that millions have suffered, we're now supposed to cheer their heroic attempt to clean up their own mess. Regional and smaller banks are still crumbling, while the Wall Street gangs are on government life support. Do you ever wonder where the feds get the money? Well, basically, they print it out of thin air. Check out Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. Only Congress is granted the power to coin money and regulate the value thereof. No separate agency or concession like the Federal Reserve is given the power. But today they aren't even required to send a budget to Congress. The Federal Reserve can enter into agreements with foreign banks and governments that we can't find out about. The dozen regional Federal Reserves around the country have bankers on their boards who tell them what they should be thinking about. And the Fed basically owns the economics profession. Their Board of Governors has 220 Ph.D. economists on its payroll, not to mention scores more with the regional banks, plus all the research and support staff. Ron Paul, a congressman I admire, has introduced the Federal Reserve Transparency Act, calling for more effective oversight and auditing of the Fed. Paul points out that since the Fed was created almost 100 years ago, the dollar has lost more than 95% of its purchasing power. Only big spending politicians and politically favored bankers benefit from inflation, Paul says. Bernanke has said that an audit would mean a takeover of monetary policy by the Congress. Perish the thought. The reality is that the road we're currently on leads to the corporate state, a fusion of private and public power, a privileged club that dominates everything else from the top down. Mussolini once had a term for that. He called it fascism. Almost 700 execs who participated in running our economy into the ground have received more than $1 million apiece in bonuses. Goldman Sachs had a spectacularly profitable first half of 2009 due to less competition, go figure why, and a revenue surge from trading foreign currency and bonds. Goldman's 30,000 employees will each earn an average of $700,000 this year. Good old Warren Buffett, who thought smart and bought $5 billion in Goldman shares in January, had already scored $1 billion on that investment. Edward Liddy, the dollar-a-year guy who was installed by our government as AIG's new CEO, happens to still own a significant stake in Goldman, so I guess he's doing all right. The banking lobby in Congress frankly own the place, Illinois Senator Dick Durbin has said. Over the last decade, the financial sector spent over $5 billion on lobbying and federal campaign contributions. Nearly half the members of the Senate Banking Committee, which happens to oversee the bailout bucks, had holdings in the same financial institutions that gained funds from the Troubled Asset Relief Program, TARP. If TARP had been a credit card, it would have been called carte blanche. In April 2009, the Treasury Department's Special Inspector General came out with a report describing TARP as mismanaged and ripe for fraud. There's no accountability. Hedge funds, which are still completely unregulated, have been brought into the program as key players. A few months before Neel Kashkari got appointed to run TARP, he told a group of bankers that there is no problem here with the subprime mortgage crisis. A real forward-thinking fellow. There wasn't even anyone within the TARP office to keep track of the money as it was being dispersed. TARP gave that job, along with a $20 million fee, to a private contractor, Bank of New York Mellon, which also happened to be one of the Big Nine. So here was a case of a beneficiary helping to oversee a process in which it was a direct participant. There was enormous potential for conflicts of interest, and no procedure to deal with them. Another example of a company that came in under the TARP, so to speak, GE Capital. We all think of General Electric in terms of light bulbs and home appliances, along with ownership of NBC, but its finance wing is GE Capital, which lends out money for real estate ventures and Walmart credit cards and the like. They'd be the seventh largest bank in the U.S., if they were classified that way. But since GE Capital is an arm of an industrial corporation, they can put forth handsome finance arrangements for those who purchase their products. And when the bailout happened, they ended up somehow qualifying for a government-guaranteed program, allowing them to raise almost $75 billion by the close of the first quarter in 2009. The debt comes due when FDIC guarantees run out in 2012. In the banking realm, that's called the cliff. It seems like there's quite a few of those pinnacles to climb and fall down. President Obama's largest private campaign donor was Goldman Sachs, whose employees coughed up $981,000 to him during the presidential campaign. I would have a hard time sleeping at night if I was running for public office and knew Goldman Sachs was my top contributor. But that's what makes me different from a Democrat or a Republican. To them, it's all about winning. Altogether, Obama got $9.9 million from Wall Street bankers, investment, and security firms. No matter how nice we think the president is and what a brilliant speaker he is, he's still beholden to these power brokers. I don't hold out much hope for the new Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission to be any different than the Warren Commission or the 9/11 Commission when it comes to exposing the truth. Look who Obama named as his chief economic advisor. Lawrence Summers, the ex-Harvard president who made $5.2 million for a one-day-a-week job with a hedge fund, D.H. Shaw, in 2008, and simultaneously earned $2.7 million in speaking fees from folks like Goldman and Citigroup. In a past lifetime, Summers joined with Rubin and Greenspan in the bankers' crusade to stop the government from regulating the same financial derivatives market that ended up causing the economic meltdown. Then there's Obama's Treasury Secretary, Timothy Geithner. He's the fellow who, while president of the New York Fed, suggested to Paulson and other economic bigwigs in June 2008 that the president should be given broad power to guarantee all debt in the banking system, considered politically unfeasible at the time, as it potentially put taxpayers on the hook for trillions. The government has since come to largely embrace his blue sky prescription. During his 5 years at the New York Fed, Geithner presided over an era of unbridled and ultimately disastrous risk-taking by the financial industry, while wining and dining with all the titans. So are we surprised that Geithner's calendars show the top execs of Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, and J.P. Morgan being the select group he's always on the phone with? At least 80 contacts during Geithner's first 7 months. At Treasury, Geithner's chief of staff is Mark Patterson, who, a year earlier, was a Goldman Sachs lobbyist fighting against a bill Senator Obama introduced to try and rein in compensation for execs. Patterson is now the main man administering the bailout dough. William Dudley, new president of the New York Fed, is another Goldman alum. Is it coincidental that by being allowed to become a bank holding company, Goldman's main overseer is now the New York Fed. I doubt they'll be terribly concerned about things like the $54.7 million Goldman CEO Lloyd Blankenfein took home in compensation in 07. As for the health care debate, insurance industry lobbyists are opposing reform at a record pace, having spent an astounding $32 million on TV ads as of October. Have you ever heard of the MLR? That stands for Medical Loss Ratio, the fancy term used by health insurance companies for their slice, their takeout, their pound of flesh, their gross, very gross profit. The MLR is the difference between what you pay an insurance company and what that insurer pays out to doctors, hospitals, and pharmacists for your medical care. The MLR is about to top $250 billion a year. AIG has kicked up their loss ratio by nearly 500%. Are we that selfish a nation where health care can be such a divisive issue? Where is mainstream America today? To me, the doctor issue is a human right. I don't care if you're an illegal alien or whatever. If you're sick, you should be able to have treatment. It amazes me that we've got people out there holding signs and making our president look like a Nazi because he supports a change in the system. Here's another point. If government-run health care is so bad, does that mean we've been screwing over our veterans for close to 100 years? My father would go nowhere else but to the Veterans Administration Hospital. The one here in Minneapolis is state-of-the-art, brand new, and completely government-run. And I don't see anyone protesting about that. If it's good enough for the veterans, shouldn't it be the same for all of us? As I write this, unemployment stands at 10% of our workforce. Foreclosures are still happening at around 10,000 a day. People defaulting on their credit cards has hit a record. And across the country, the states are having to slice crucial services to the bone. As governor, when we had a budget that went over what we budgeted, I gave checks back to the people. That was a true stimulus package. When people at home have more money in their pockets, they tend to spend it. Cutting taxes also stimulates the economy, as much as Democrats hate the sound of it. In this case, the taxes coming out of our pockets are just making the rich get richer. 9 of the financial firms that were among the largest recipients of federal bailout money paid about 5,000 of their traders and bankers bonuses of more than $1 million apiece for 2008. For the fiscal year that ended in October 2008, the IRS audited only about 4 out of every 100 Americans who showed income of $1 million and up. IRS data also showed that the income of the 400 wealthiest individuals in the country hit an average of $263 million in 2006. Within a decade, their share of our nation's wealth almost doubled to more than 22%. Meantime, the offshore tax havens haven't gone away. Citigroup, for example, has 91 subsidiaries in Luxembourg and another 90 in the Cayman Islands, out of 427 units in 23 countries altogether. The Caymans are part of Great Britain, and more than 12,000 companies operate out of a single building there. The Caymans lay claim to being the 5th largest center of bank deposits in the world. While it's true that the shares, bonds, and cash are technically on the islands, they're actually headquartered back in New York. The $1.9 trillion in bank deposits, although it's invested in the U.S. and abroad, remains invisible to the IRS. If you ever wondered why Enron paid no taxes, that's because they created hundreds of these paper companies. Oh, and Dick Cheney's Halliburton subsidiary, KBR, pays at least 21,000 of its employees through subsidiaries in the Caymans. That's called globalization, I guess. just like IBM sending its laid-off American workers overseas to countries like India, where your skills are in demand. Fed Chairman Bernanke is also a board member of something called the Bank for International Settlements, based in Basel, Switzerland. The BIS encouraged all the speculative investment banking that led to our current debacle. Carol Quigley, in Tragedy and Hope, wrote that the BIS was created as the apex of a world system of financial control in private hands, able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole. The goal being control, in a feudalist fashion, by the central banks of the world acting in concert by secret agreements arrived at in frequent private meetings and conferences. Based inside the BIS is a new agency called the Financial Stability Board. It's proposed to strengthen and institutionalize a mandate to promote global financial stability. Sounds good. But some see this as the latest sinister development in a centuries-old consolidation of power by an international financial oligarchy. Third-world countries who can't pay off their debts would be required to sell off their national assets to private investors. The board has oversight over all systematically important financial institutions, instruments, and markets, like gold, oil, and food, maybe? Yet there's no treaty involved, merely a private committee looking out for national sovereignty. Seems like the fulfillment of what banker Mayer Rothschild said back in 1791. Allow me to issue and control a nation's currency, and I care not who makes its laws. Thomas Jefferson warned the country back in 1815. The dominion which the banking institutions have obtained over the minds of our citizens must be broken, or it will break us. Is it naive to think about banking returning to the austere, staid practice of simply taking deposits and making conservative loans at low interest rates to qualified borrowers under rigid regulations administered by moderately paid federal employees? Wouldn't that greatly reduce systemic risk? Here's what some smart economists think we need to do. Reinstate the Glass-Steagall Act and wall off commercial banking from investment bank gambling and require strict leverage limits. Insulate the federally insured depositors from reckless investment schemes with no social utility whatsoever, like these credit default swaps that are entered into by entities that don't own the underlying bonds. Withdraw the massive handouts and taxpayer-backed guarantees given to prop up specific banks and financial institutions, and use these funds to instead support the struggling homeowners and defaulting borrowers who form the root of this crisis. This will reduce the record rate of foreclosures and put a floor under asset prices at a sustainable level, which will in turn stabilize financial institutions that are still hemorrhaging from increasing foreclosures and loan defaults. In other words, bottoms up, not top-down economic support. Let the already insolvent banks go bankrupt and begin removing the bad debt from the system. We need a sound banking system, but there is no reason we need the specific banks we have now. There are plenty of regional and community banks in this country which avoided exposure to risky mortgage and credit derivatives and which would gladly replace the market share held by the two bloated-to-fail banks for loans issued to small businesses and consumers if they were able to compete in a truly free market against these subsidized behemoths. In short, why doesn't the public demand a financial system that serves the people, rather than enslaves us to a treadmill of debt? The national debt is basically what the government owes from years of borrowing money to pay off the yearly deficits, the amount by which spending exceeds revenue from taxes and the like. Back in 1791, our national debt was $75 million. Today, it rises by that amount every hour or so. During the years of Bush II, the national debt increased by over 65% to nearly $10 trillion. Now there's talk among some of our creditors, like China, which has, of November 2007, held $390 billion of our debt, about replacing the dollar as the world's reserve currency. But we keep right on spending money we don't really have to players who don't deserve it. A Congressional Oversight Panel report early in 2009 said the Bush administration had overpaid the banks by tens of billions for stocks and other assets in the bailout. Our economy has been captured by an alien power, not the Klingons, but the kleptos. We can't go on like this. A much worse disaster than we faced in 2008 is in the wind, without something real being done about this mess that the government Wall Street conspiracy created. Can we still heed the words of Andrew Jackson when he said to a delegation of bankers in 1832, "Gentlemen, I have had men watching you for a long time, and I am convinced that you have used the funds of the bank to speculate in the breadstuffs of the country. When you won, you divided the profits amongst you, and when you lost, you charged it to the bank. You tell me that if I take the deposits from the bank and annul its charter, I shall ruin 10,000 families. That may be true, gentlemen, but that is your sin. Should I let you go on, you will ruin 50,000 families, and that would be my sin. You are a den of vipers and thieves. I intend to rout you out. I'm ready to see a rout that restores our republic to the principles of Jefferson and Jackson. How about you? What should we do now? When the average American is on the edge of losing it all, at the same time the fat cats are getting even fatter, it's time to call their bluff, folks. We need to realize first that we've become a corporatized state, one that our government is beholden to while the majority of us are held hostage by it. We should be demanding that President Obama put people in charge who weren't part of the problem. We should be battering at the gates of Goldman Sachs and AIG and the Federal Reserve, too, letting the pillagers take the fall they deserve.